Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And we get together every week. And we are live today. Welcome to our table. We are live here at the KHOI Community Radio Studios in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa.
Way too beautiful.
Oh, way too beautiful.
Way too beautiful.
Yeah. The studio is great. The weather's lovely. And welcome back, Donna. You have been away for a while, but you are back.
Yes, couldn't stay away from this beautiful city of Ames.
So we've got lots to talk about, and we've got are planning a whole series of interesting stuff for these upcoming Donald on the Kitchen shows.
Yeah, there's a lot of food activity in town. Just beginning. Here we go.
And today, Donna came back from being away for a while, and actually she was out of the country, so she came back, and we've got a new president, and all sorts of things are falling by the wayside, and people are upset, and people are in the streets. And
it's never a dull moment, is there?
No, it's kind of, kind of out of our, get out of our slumber and kind of get up there and kind of thinking about what we want this world to be. Today we're going to explore what this new political climate, among the other things, has to do with what we eat. It all kind of comes down to the table. Who do we trust when it comes to information on our health or on how our food is grown? Who do we trust? So there's been word about truthiness. I like that word, truthiness.
Truthiness?
Yeah, it's sort of.
Maybe
truth.
that'll be the. Does that have to do with alternative facts?
That too.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know.
Truthiness. Okay.
So we're going to kind of explore, because when you get down to putting things in your mouth and sustaining yourself with food, you kind of want to know what's going on. And Donna's got some information about that. And I have a recipe to share. But first, I'd like to start this show off with a poem. This poem is about a very basic element. It's about water. Yeah, we've heard that water is life. Where have we heard that? Anyway, this is a poem about water by a poet named Tony Hoagland. And our thoughts go out to water protectors everywhere. This poem is called The Social Life of Water. All water is part of other water. Clouds talk to lake. Mist speaks quietly to creek. Lake says something back to the cloud, and cloud listens. No water is lonely water. All water is a part of other water. River rushes to reunite with ocean. Tree drinks the rain and sweats out dew. Dew takes the elevator into the cloud. Cloud marries the puddle. Puddle has long conversations with lake about fjord. Fog sneaks up and murmurs insinuations to the swamp. Swamp makes its needs known to the marshland. Thunderstorm throws itself on the estuary. Waterspout laughs at the joke of the fog pond. All water understands. All water understands. Reservoir gathers information for database of watershed. Brook translates lake to waterfall. Tide wrinkles its green forehead and then breaks through. All water understands. But you stand on the shore in the evening and listen, grieving as something stirs and turns within you, not knowing why you linger in the dark, not able to even guess from what you are excluded. All water understands. That was a poem called The Social Life of Water by Tony Hoagland. Tony Hoagland is a writer who lives in Wellfleet, Massachusetts. His work includes a collection of poems published by Gray Wolf Press entitled What Narcissism Means to Me. That's a nice collection. And his most recent book is called The Unincorporated Persons in the Late Honda Dynasty. And a little note here. He says his favorite spiritual practice is to leap naked into cold water.
Speaking of leaping naked into cold water, I was out at Peterson's Pits with the dogs a few days ago, and there was another nice local gentleman out there checking out, you know, if the ice fishing season was going to be,
I think it's, yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Kind of thin out there.
Yeah, now. I don't know. Well, there was somebody out fishing, and then they had a big conversation, but the gentleman I was talking to was saying, you know, I like scuba diving, and I like ice fishing. But I don't want to do them both at the same time.
Well put. Well put. Yes, yes, yes. So, speaking of leaping naked into cold water, it's kind of like what this new president sort of has done to a lot of us. We're sort of have had this wake-up call. And time to think about, as Donna mentioned, time to think about alternative facts and what exactly is going on. Who do we listen to? What do you have for us, Donna?
Well, yes, Lana mentioned a new word. It's called truthiness. I don't know where you saw that. But
Stephen Colbert.
Truthiness. Truthiness. Okay.
He claims to have invented it actually about a year ago during the campaign, the presidential campaign, because it seems things are kind of getting a little mushy out there.
Well, this is certainly true in the food world. I was reading another, you know, we're still in the trends for 2017, and one of the trends I was reading someplace or other was the post-truth era's implications on food and beverage. So what they are saying is 2017 is ushering us into a post-truth era where people trust their gut and others' opinions more than they do the experts. From genetic modification to gluten, from sugar to supplements, consumers are getting their information from varying sources, and this is not the alt-right publications, but they are getting it from varying sources, and they have diverse opinions on subjects that impact food decisions. Now, of course, they're talking about, you know, GMOs and sugar and this and that, and another favorite one that we're talking about, the glyphosate argument.
There is so much to read on a packaged bit of food that you can spend a lot of time just reading in the supermarket.
Well, and I think, you know, it's not just that consumers have gone crazy and they don't know what, you know, they're just going, oh, I think this is true, so therefore I'm going to da-da-da. I think at least in food, and this is probably not true in politics, but in food, part of the problem is that the quote-unquote science, and most consumers know this, that the scientific research agenda in many fields, but we'll just speak to food because that's our field of expertise here. Anyway, the science in food, of course, and this goes back to my usual thing, which I've said a thousand times, we know how to send a moon to the rocket, but we don't really know what's going on in our guts exactly.
That's true.
But anyway, the science is, you know, somebody pays for this science, right? And it's the outcomes or the issues studied in the science are, in fact, influenced, how could this be, by who pays for the study.
Yes, and knowing that is a good place to start being a tiny bit skeptical.
Right, right. So for the average person, you know, you'll read a headline, and I have to say, I personally think that oftentimes journalists have not dug deeply enough. You know, there is this thing where you have to present all the alternatives no matter how far-fetched, and if 1% of the population, for example, thinks climate change isn't real, then they get 50% of the coverage. However, in the food world, often a new study will come out that says, yada, da, 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 da. And it's difficult to know who did the study, who paid for the study, and if the piece of journalism does not really indicate that, that leaves it up to the consumer. It's an awful lot of homework. For the normal people to know whether they want to eat this can of peas or that can of or frozen or, you know, it's just too much to keep track of. I did see an interesting article. Okay, there's this nutrition bar or whatever, you can see them. And I know that they have them in health food stores. It's called, the brand name is called Kind, K-I-N-D. And it's a delicious, there are multiple flavors. It's mostly fruits and nuts and things like that. So this product is maybe a few years old, but it's become a really big business. So
it sounds like a good thing. Instead of grabbing what we've learned, oh, sugar's bad for you, so we don't want a candy bar. But if something is called a health bar or a Kind bar, and it's got, the label says,
right,
nuts.
They put them right by the checkout.
Yeah.
So
this
anyway,
is good.
This company has decided, among other companies, that they're going to give $25 million for research into the influence on nutrition policy.
Oh, research into the influence.
Right, because, you know, when you get the every so often the federal government comes out with, well, you know, you should eat a lot of fiber but not too much fats and this and that. And this is recalculated every few years. And it is mostly influenced by, like, the sugar industry, the meat industry, the dairy industry. So this gentleman is giving a lot of money because he says every special interest has an enormous amount of resources. Sorry, but the public doesn't. So, what he wants to do is,
But he has made a contribution of $5 million through his donor-advised fund and plans to throw in another $20 million over the next decade. He's enlisted influential names about nutrition policy to nominate a board of directors.
And these names are people that have been public advocates.
Oh, I see.
For a long time, Marion Nestle and Center for the, what is it called?
Center for Science and the Public Interest.
Right. So what happened to him and his company is his product, which is labeled as natural, came, or healthy, I believe it was, came under fire because it has a lot of nuts. So it has a higher fat content. And there was a certain restriction of what you could call healthy. And if it had too much fat, it was not considered healthy. But that's ridiculous because nuts are very healthy.
So they weren't considering what kind of fat.
So
there's a fat lobby or a anti-fat lobby.
Yes. Oh, and you know who the anti-fat lobby is? The sugar lobby.
What?
Yes.
So what does sugar have against fat?
Well, it goes back to, and this is probably more than 20 years ago, actually much more than 20 years ago. There was a point where the public health officials became really concerned about heart disease and arterial clogging and blah, 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 blah. So the research choices were fat is doing this or sugar is doing this, right?
Well, only those two things. That's what they studied.
Those were the two things that were really, really implicated the most.
Okay.
So we went down, in this country, we went down the fat road.
Oh, we did.
Everybody knows that. Don't eat too much fat, you know. Then we made, like, fat-free cookies, fat-free this, fat-free that. But what happened was that the health profile that they were studying did not go down. We still had as many heart attacks and that sort of thing. And then it was like, oh, well, everybody's eating less fat. But what are they eating? More sugar.
Oh, I suppose. Well,
and it was the sugar lobby that heavily, heavily influenced that, because there is a sugar lobby. The fat lobby actually is not a fat lobby. It's maybe the meat industry, the dairy industry. You know, they weren't as proactive in their concerted efforts in controlling the research, let us say.
Also, it's a marketing sort of thing. You probably wouldn't want to be known as the fat lobby. No.
Well, but now there's the sweet lobby, right?
Well,
that sounds a lot
sweet,
better, right?
Well, we like sweet. Because it talks to something in us. We like sweet. But the sugar lobby is very powerful.
So we'll go back to this Kind candy bar. It says, in 2015, the FDA warned Kind that the, quote, healthy claim on some of its bars ran afoul of the agency's rules, which says that the product with more than 1 gram of saturated fat can't be labeled healthy. Some Kind bars have as much as 5 grams of saturated fat. Later that year, Kind petitioned the agency to reconsider, saying its regulations stemmed from outdated science that vilified fats, even those in nutrient-dense foods. Under the existing rules, Kind argued sugary cereals can be considered healthy, while salmon, avocados, and nuts cannot be.
Oh, because it's so, cut and dried there.
Yeah, so okay. that's a very clear... For example, this man who has a company who is making money and, you know, he's saying that the science is biased against him. But what he's doing instead of, you know, funding his own study is he's actually funding some outside experts, some sort of more public advocate, people who are known for public advocacy and not particularly bought and sold by any particular industry. So he is asking them to do a little more research into these kinds of issues, which is the kind of science that I think all of us are hoping for and used to be, or is maybe this in my rose-colored glasses of my childhood, science used to be perhaps more unbiased. I'm not sure. Maybe it was all along and we didn't know. But
it's good to know about this. Be aware of who is telling you what and what their
interests uh-huh. might be.
Oh, so good.
Which brings us to another argument that we've been having on air.
Uh-huh.
These are the questions about glyphosate. Uh-huh. Okay, so glyphosate, as you all probably have heard from me millions of times, is also Roundup, which is widely, widely, widely used here in our own backyard. So we are particularly interested in this particular battle. So it kind of started at the UN. One of the agencies of the UN decided that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. Well, the manufacturers of glyphosate, which is, I believe, Monsanto and others of their ilk, are up in arms. Of course, our product is perfectly helpful, healthy. We've tested it. We've done this. We've done that. So it is very, very controversial. Now, why a body of the UN would, you know, what is their science doing? What are they looking at? Okay, it turns out that, of course, there are studies done by non-industry members, apparently, that do show some problems with glyphosate. Whereas the studies that Monsanto has put forward, of course, confirm that their product is completely harmless. Now, you know, me, poor consumer, you know, frankly, I, of course, choose to try to find foods that have no pesticides at all, or herbicides. Glyphosate is an herbicide. However, in the environment that we live in here, it is probably, this is my consumer perspective. I'm not a scientist. It's probably in the air we breathe. It's probably in the water. Now, please realize this is my personal, my post-truth opinion.
Well, it's time to be a little skeptical, and it's time to ask.
I'm suspicious. Yeah. So here's a new thing that has come along, because I've been really following this glyphosate. And by the way, in Europe, they're taking this all very seriously in terms of banning it or restricting it, or really they're looking at it in the European Union much more seriously than, of course, we in America are looking at it because, frankly, it's an American product. So, anyway, there is a new thing that's coming along. We are going to have a, just like we have a non-GMO label, there's a company offering to do a non-glyphosate label.
Oh.
I know.
Good. Something else to read in the supermarket aisles. Yes.
Mostly it's going to be honey companies have signed up for this for some reason. However, not that I expect to see these labels around a lot here, especially in Iowa, but I thought it was interesting that there's enough controversy stirred up that actually some companies are signing up for this service to be able to have their product verified as glyphosate-free and to put a label on their jar.
And as you were saying before, it seems like more of us are trusting our own our own brains, okay? We hear all this information, all of these advertisings and all of these assurances by the government that things are safe for us, but...
Well, more than the government. It's also, it's in the newspapers. I mean, about 2 years ago, Monsanto initiated some sort of new PR push where they really reached out to journalists, and I saw a whole spate of articles in places that one would not have expected, like National Geographic or Mother News Network or whatever that's called, kind of more pro-GMO. And, you know, obviously they sent somebody around and pointed out their science. And, you know, it's still very controversial. I'm sorry, there is research on both sides of the fence. No matter how much the GMO lobby declares that the science is settled, no, it's not. You can do your research. You can see it is not a settled deal. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have your own opinions, but and buy accordingly and eat accordingly, to each his own. I mean, we do have that freedom left. But please, you know, if you dig a little deeper, just I know we none of us have time for these kinds of details, but, you know, that's one thing Lana and I do. And when we sort of spout our opinions here and you know, I'm not saying trust us, but I do want you to know that we have all done a little bit more research than the average consumer.
Right. And be aware, too, that the word post-truth, that's not the first time I've heard of it. Somehow alternative facts and post-truth is kind of in the back of our minds or on the tips of our ears for a lot of subjects. And be aware that it is in our
interest. Truth is,
interest.
It seems to be a slippery and more slippery slope these days. What is that old poem? Who is that? And truth is beauty, and beauty is truth, and that's all we need to know. So I can't remember. That's an old one that I had to read in high school.
Oh.
But
well,
truth is beautiful, but where the hell is it? What is it? It's really hard to know.
So here we are around the kitchen table talking about food and who do we trust? And be a little skeptical out there, folks, and read those labels. You are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a fine dance tune called Le Diable Vert, the Green Devil. There you go. We're here in the kitchen today talking about truthiness and all those things that we read on food labels. One of the things that I always kind of take note of, Donna, is people are trying to be helpful when they try to sell us their products, and they have a sell-by date, or be careful, or,
okay.
Yeah, here we go.
A little more confusion here. Let's see. As much as 40% of food goes uneaten in the U.S., according to the government, Americans throw away 165 billion in wasted food every year. So we have a new proposal from the government. Of course, this is strictly volunteer. All of those things that used to say, and this will go into effect sometime this year, sell by, use by, best before, they're not very regulated terms. So what the government has proposed, now, Lana, you tell me what you think. We're going to have two new labels. We're going to have two choices. One is going to be, whoops, where did I go? Best if used by. Oh. And used by.
Okay.
Those are the two choices. Now, what do you think they mean?
Okay, like if
this is supposed to clarify the issue
if
here.
If this was on a carton of milk, and I saw used by, and I saw best if used by, I would smell it first. Isn't that what I'm supposed to do?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but you're buying it. You can't just open it up and smell it. If it's in your refrigerator, you can do that.
Okay.
And that, I would say, is always the bottom line. If it looks funny or smells funny, don't eat it, right?
Oh, but if this is in the store, is it safe to buy something that says used by?
It's good. Huh. You will, two different products will, the used by, according to them, is supposed to be on, would indicate a product that is highly perishable and or has food safety concerns over time.
Oh.
So like the salsa that you buy that's prepared, not the kind in the bottle, but the kind that's, okay, that. And best if used by would communicate quality where the product is still safe to consume after the date. So I suppose that's like canned things, packaged things, shelf stable things.
Might be a funny color, but okay to eat.
Yeah, so pretty soon everything will be marked either best if used by for the more stable products and used by, which I think it is meant to alert you, you know, there's not as much wiggle room in this product. Mm-hmm. So this is supposed to clarify some of these issues. We shall see.
Well, this goes back to the fact that we're throwing away a lot of food, so there must be a lot. They make more than we need, at least people that can afford it. A lot of this food goes to food pantries, and they have to probably keep track of these used-by labels pretty darn well.
Well, you know, one thing I think we'll do is we'll give, when this comes into effect, we'll give Food at First a call, because in Ames we have really solved a huge amount of this problem, is that all the products or a lot of the products around town in some of our major, like Walmart contributes to this, the products that have expired according to the current labeling system are sent to Food at First, which is our really great local meal service and food pantry. And we'll see how this change is going to affect them, and we will let you know.
Oh, all right, good. So there's something else that we have to kind of be aware of and make our own judgments on. Sell by,
best if used by, yeah, or used by.
Okay.
Okay.
Something else.
Very simple, isn't that?
Oh, we'll keep it.
This is more of these government regulations here, right?
If we figure this out, we'll let you know.
Okay. We do have a positive bit of news.
Oh, right.
Yes, our First Lady, Melania Trump, who has not moved to the White House, has nevertheless indicated one bit of First Lady news.
Ah.
Yes, she is going to keep the White House garden.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Thank goodness. But here's what has happened. It has become, the White House garden has become sort of a charming bit of, Michelle Obama says, quote, "My husband will tell you, one of the most frequently asked questions he gets from world leaders are, how is your wife's garden?"
Isn't that a nice thing
to
ask?
Yeah, they don't have to just ask about the weather. So it's a big deal. So one of the things that the Obama administration has sought to eliminate any, because every new incoming administration is allowed to do whatever they want, basically, with the White House lawn and the White House and da-da-da-da-da.
Yes, I remember that President Reagan quite swiftly removed the solar panels that
exactly.
Jimmy Carter put up. So you can do whatever you want. But in this case, well, maybe that garden
so,
is okay.
So Michelle did a very clever thing. What she did in the waning years of her husband's administration was that she went to the University, Virginia School of Architecture, and they helped update and the design and layout, and they put in more permanent things. And she got a grant from where the National Park Foundation is a nonprofit that supports the national park system. They got a grant for $2.5 million from the Burpee Foundation to maintain the White House garden. So she got it funded, and then she put in some more substantial, iron fences.
Infrastructure.
And one of the things she put in was a large – she paved the pathways, and she put in a large paving stone that has the inscription, White House Kitchen Garden, established in 2009 by First Lady Michelle Obama with the hope of growing a healthier nation for our children. Now, who could remove that?
Very good. So that's
and,
good news.
And she noted that the new structures incorporated both wood – chosen for durability and steel, quote, combined to make the elements stronger, bonded together than they, she had an installation which includes pine and walnut harvested from the estates of the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, and the birthplace of Martin Luther King Jr. Now, that will be hard to eliminate, and fortunately, Melania has seen the charms of it, and we will be still having the White House garden.
Good news, good news on the national front.
Yes, the women are keeping it together, at least in the administration. They're not busy undoing each other's legacies. I'm proud to see that.
Very good. That's some good news in our post-truth world. Ho, ho, ho.
We get to keep the garden. Oh, boy.
Well, here around the kitchen table, I brought a show-and-tell item, or maybe it's a taste-and-smell item.
Yeah, which is hard to do on radio, but we're going to give it a try here.
We do this occasionally. I have a recipe I'd like to share, and it's called Hot Pepper Relish. And people may have their own version of this, but mine.
By way of, it has a seasonal. She's not going out into her garden and picking the relish.
No, it's... I bring it up now because...
We're doing freezer diving, right?
Yes. I was diving around in my freezer this time of year, finding those interesting little things that you save, and label, of course. And I remember that I had frozen peppers. Now, I had frozen sweet peppers, and I had frozen hot peppers. And it just happens to fit this recipe just fine. This is a sweet and savory recipe. And... I have it here in... Donna, kind of explain what we have here.
Well, she brought a little... Is this cream cheese? Is that what we're doing?
This recipe, I got this recipe from my sister-in-law.
Oh, right. This is a classic hors d'oeuvre. Midwestern hors d'oeuvre, I believe.
It is.
Is that true?
Now in her family, hot peppers were not included. This started out as a sweet pepper relish.
Right. And because it's an hors d'oeuvre, because the color of red of the peppers is very, very attractive.
It's very lovely. And it's traditionally served with cream cheese and crackers.
On a saltine cracker. Oh, yum, yum, yum.
On a saltine cracker.
I'm having it. Mm-mm-mm.
That's where the recipe came from. Ages ago, I had this recipe called red pepper sauce. Now, of course, I can never leave anything as is. I always have to dink around with things. And I love growing peppers. So I just happen to have... peppers. And over the years, I've added more hot peppers to the mix. You can do that.
This isn't too hot, Lana.
No.
It's bearable for the Midwestern palate.
Right.
I love it.
Right. I'll give you the recipe here in a minute. And I've also added lime juice to it because I think that helps keep it a little
more than lime
light.
Juice. Didn't you just put the whole lime in?
I did. I doubled the recipe when I made this recipe, and I figured, well, here's this lime. I'll just throw it in.
Right, because the first bite I got had a beautiful, tiny little chunk of the actual lime skin, and I thought that was perfect.
Well, yeah, that's good. That's good. This is a good recipe to make this time of year, I said, because it calls for frozen sliced and seeded sweet peppers, and as many of your favorite hot peppers as you like. Freezing the peppers before you grind them in the food processor gives this recipe a chunky relish feel on the tongue. I've also processed the peppers without freezing, just throw them in, put them in the food processor and mush them around. But the relish is just a little bit runnier. It's more like a puree. It tastes
just as
good.
You mean using fresh?
Fresh. You can make this fresh peppers. It's fine and dandy. But the difference between this and having it more like a puree, I like it to be a little chunkier anyway. And also, you can run across recipes for hot pepper jellies, too. But this is not a jelly. Hot pepper jellies, the ones that I've sort of looked up, are a sweet sugar sauce, sugar water, that has hot peppers marinated in them. And it just added the hot peppers.
So they're using an already canned pepper.
Right. And that ends up kind of being a clear jelly with hot sauce added, hot pepper added. That's fine. But this has got the whole pepper. There's even a few seeds in there, too.
That's really good.
And good. So that's it. It's not a jelly. It is a relish.
All right. Tell us how to do it, and then I'm going to tell you where the controversy lies this recipe.
Oh, good. I love it. Well, here. Let's see. Why don't you make up a taste for our fine engineer, Evan, over there.
Okay, Evan.
Because it's good to have some people crunching food and making yummy noises while they do this.
Yeah, spilling cracker crumbs all over the microphones.
There we go. So, recipe for hot pepper relish.
Here we go, Evan.
6 cups total ground sweet and hot peppers. Now, this recipe, the way I like it, and it's you have to know your peppers. I use 5 cups of sweet peppers and 1 cup of hot peppers. Then,
I have a question, Lana. Yeah. If you're taking them frozen, mm-hmm. How are you going to get cup measurements?
I measure them after I grind them. Very good, huh?
Okay, that's backwards, but okay.
I know it's backwards.
All right. But she's obviously eyeballing it, folks. She found some peppers in bags, freezer.
Some. That's how I cook.
Some.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I promise to have Donna look over this recipe before we post it on the website, because I always do things with some. So here's my version. So 6 cups total ground sweet and hot peppers. Now, it's best to grind them frozen.
Grind in the food processor?
Yeah, food processor. Cuisinart.
So you just put them in.
Yep.
Oh, you run them through the feeding tube?
Yep.
So are you using a shredding blade?
Yes.
Ha! See? Okay. My mind, I was already just dumping them right in and using the regular round circulating blade. No.
Okay.
Here
we go.
Okay.
Here we go. All right. See, it's always good to have a cook here because I kind
Lana
of make things.
Don't worry.
I cook from the hip. You got to be careful here. So to those 6 cups total of hot and sweet peppers.
Fed through the feeding tube into the shredder blade.
Cuisinart.
Not the slicer blade. Okay.
Then you end up with a frozen, kind of like a slushy. Then I dump that into my pan.
Where did you put the lime?
I'm not there yet.
Oh.
Then I put 3 cups of sugar into the pan.
Okay.
And then I grind up one small lime for this whole thing.
All right. That goes through the shredder blade as well. Okay.
I guess you can put that with it.
Seeds and all.
Why not?
She's loose here.
I am. And then 1 1/2 cups dark apple cider vinegar in a heavy bottom pan. Cook until thick. And it takes about 2 hours. You bring it to a boil.
That's quite a bit of vinegar and sugar.
You bring it to a boil. And then simmer about 2 hours. Simmer. Don't let it boil hard. You don't want it to turn dark. You stir often. You put it into small jars.
Right, because this is a beautiful color.
Yep. You don't want to cook it too long. You can kind of burn. It tastes okay, but it looks kind of dark, and it's nice to have it bright red. I think the lime helps that. Now you can put it in small jars. Keep it in the refrigerator, or you Put in a small jar hot, and if you put a canning lid on it, you can hot pack it. It works fine. Then serve it with cream cheese and crackers. It is great at a potluck.
You know, I think it also would be really good, like use like a chutney on a fish or a chicken dish.
Oh, it'd
or
be great
pork.
On fish. It'd be great on fish.
There are a lot of uses for this. Now, Lana left out her major secret.
What?
The Maslin pan.
Oh, I have. I love making jelly.
This becomes easy when you have the right pan. Otherwise, the danger of you need a thick-bottomed pan.
Yes, this is one of those long cooking things. Get a thick-bottomed kettle pan to cook this
in. Do you think you could do it in a crock pot?
Oh, I bet you could overnight. You want to evaporate a little bit of the liquid? Yeah, that's good. And if it's a little runny, that's fine. That's fine. So I have something called a Maslin pan. I got it on the internet. Maslin. It is a very heavy-bottomed pan made for making jelly. It has a little spout on one side. And
they're
really
beautiful.
Nice. Oh, they're great.
Yours is stainless steel,
Stainless
right?
steel.
They do come in copper, but
traditionally, they come in copper. I did not spring for the copper Maslin pan.
No, they're also, then you have to clean them.
Yeah. So, this is a good use for my jelly-making pan. It has a heavy bottom. I love it. Now, this hot pepper relish recipe will depend on the kind of peppers you have. Here's some of my favorite peppers.
The ones that she grows herself.
I do. But any kind, you can grow peppers. The thing with peppers is that some years you have lots and other years maybe not so much, but there's always some. And here we go.
And last year was a good pepper year. Yeah. Hallelujah. Yeah.
So some of my favorite peppers, some of my favorite sweet peppers are any big bell. I mean, anything that goes red. And also, there's the bull's horn type.
Oh, they're beautiful.
The Corno Rosso is one of my favorites. Carmen is another bull's horn
type. The Corno Rosso are the pointy ones, right?
Longer.
But they're still sweet.
They're still sweet. Mm-hmm. There's a smaller one, a nice chunky one called Topepo Rosso, a little red. There's sheep nose pepper that you can get from Seed Savers Exchange.
And that's a red
sweet as well? The orange and yellow sweet peppers are good, too. That's fine. It'll change the color of the relish a little bit, but you can
It would still be beautiful.
And the hot peppers. And again, my depends on the ratio you want to deal with here. My favorite hots, and I put a combination of some of all of these are some jalapenos, some Anaheim, Big Jim Cayenne, Czech Blacks, which are a little bitty pepper kind of.
I'm assuming that you separate these by genre or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. The hots don't go in the sweet bag. Okay.
No. I have to be good at this. And my favorite one is called a Lou DeMarco pepper that is
the what?
A Lou DeMarco pepper that I got from a friend ages ago.
How do you spell
Lou,
it?
Lou.
Oh, Lou DeMarco.
Lou DeMarco was a. I heard Lou DeMarco was a professional prize fighter ages ago, along about the 20s or 30s. And
Italian, I guess.
Italian. Huh? Mm-hmm. And there was a greenhouse person in Des Moines that a friend of mine worked with him for a while, and he had this pepper, and we've been saving seeds ever since. A good one that is all,
this is an Iowa heirloom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, if you go to Seed Savers Exchange, they have a pepper called Beaver Dam, which is very, very similar. It looks like one of these, kind of a Corno Rosso, big, chunky, high-shouldered sort of thing.
Is it pointy, though?
Not quite so pointy. It's kind of an elongated bell shape, but it is medium hot, not hot, medium hot. So look for Beaver Dam peppers from Seed Savers Exchange. Yeah.
Okay, so here's the controversy. So Lana, all right, I'm going to read you a little bit from On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen by Harold McGee. Now, Harold McGee is sort of, this is like the Bible of the science behind most cooking things. So Harold he's the expert you go to. I mean, this is a reference book that I really, sometimes I read it. So he's saying this is about, because we're in the season now where we're all kind of cleaning out our freezers, using the last bits of what was last year's harvest, making room for the new harvest to come. And it's, of course, you get in there in the freezer and you think, oh, why did I put this in? What is this? Lana is probably more label conscious than I am. But But when a lot of things come up, you know, and you have lots of them and you're kind of working fast and furiously to one of my favorite things is, of course, I dealing with berries and currants and things like that. And I will, instead of making jams and jellies on the spot, I will often just cook them down, put them through the food mill and make them into pouches of bags of puree and stuff like this. So what Lana has done, well, first I'll tell you what Harold McGee says about freezing vegetables. He says here's what happens. The damage and physical disruption is caused by the water crystals. This is the water that's actually in the fruit. He says, so these water crystals, they freeze and the edges puncture the cell walls and membrane. When the food is thawed, the cell fluids leak out of the cells and the food loses crispness and becomes limp and wet. Yes, we all know what that is. Producers of frozen foods minimize the size of the ice crystals, and so it limits the amount of damage. That's why, like, if you buy frozen green beans in the store, they're not as bad as the ones that you've frozen at home in terms of color and limpness. Because they freeze the foods as quickly as possible at a low temperature, which is often minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Under these conditions, many small ice crystals form. At higher temperatures, fewer and larger crystals form and do more damage. Home and restaurant freezers are warmer than commercial freezers, and their temperatures fluctuate. So during the storage, some water melts and refreezes into larger crystals, and the food's textures suffer. He recommends, he goes on to say, another problem with freezing fruits and vegetables is that even though it's frozen, some enzymatic functions still continue. So he says to freeze your peppers, for example, mm-hmm. you are supposed to blanch them and freeze them. Ah. Now, Lana does not do that.
I don't. And just for this recipe, it works out really well.
All peppers.
It depends. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But I always put up a lot of the peppers this way because it is so easy. Remember when your late summer garden was producing too many peppers? Well, I cut my peppers in quarters, take out the seeds and the stems, and layer them on cookie sheets, and put the cookie sheets in the freezer. And I have this theory.
So that's sort of IQF.
Freezes them fast.
Individual quality frozen. Okay, so
IQF.
IQF. Yeah, that's the industry term for it. Like, and they mostly use it with berries. So, like, when you buy mm-hmm. a bag of frozen berries for your smoothies, they're not all a clump of berries. They are individually quick frozen. So that, you're doing that to your peppers.
That seems to work really well. It's simple, and I don't blanch them. I just freeze them, and then the next day, or whenever I remember, I open the freezer and put them into freezer bags and then put them back
okay,
in.
Okay.
And label those freezer bags. Like I said, I have hot peppers and I have sweet peppers. And not only I use them not only for this relish, but there's also stews and crock pots and pasta sauces and pizza.
Well, where you're going to cook them. Well, you know, okay, Harold, I'm sorry, but on this one I'm going with Lana because the color, if you're blanching, you're going to lose some of your color. And just looking at the color of Lana's pepper jelly, I must say, I'm going to freeze them whole next year.
Yeah,
just
for
like
this,
that.
Yeah.
Or no, they're cut. They're still cut, yeah. And you've taken the seeds out. So they're really ready to cook with, and they're really easy.
Right. You don't want to freeze them whole because then you have this kind of cavity in the middle that won't get frozen as well.
Well, and the other thing is once you take them out, if you haven't de-seeded them and you're de-seeding a flaccid frozen pepper, it's really annoying. It's much easier to just chop them in half or quarters and then rip the little seed bit out with your hands and boom, in it goes.
Right.
Boomsy boom.
Right.
All right. So we are into Lana's IQF non-blanched.
Yeah.
Frozen peppers, and they are a beautiful thing.
So look for the hot pepper relish recipe, which will be on the Donna Lana Kitchen website. You can go to khoifm.org. You can find out a lot of shows there, but you can find the Donna Lana Kitchen show, and there will be this recipe added to the recipe page as soon as Donna sort of tweaks the way I cook. Like I say, I cook from the hip. So Donna may even add like quantities and things. This
oh
will
no
be
no
good.
No! I'm not given to that. That would be beyond my patience level. The other thing that I've been doing, as we're of course going through the freezer and the storage bins for the long stored, the sweet potatoes and a few punny squash are left and things like that. So we've been having a lot of soups. That's, of course, this is the soup time of year. Anyway, so I was just going to give a quick review of the bases for different soups. You know, there are the easy things are stocks, vegetable, or I've been making a lot of bone broths, as we all know. That's really delicious this time of year. So you can either have a stock base or a bone broth base, or in lieu of not having any of those things, you can always use a water base. There is the milk base. I made a wonderful, let's see, what did I do? I just took cauliflower head, some potatoes that were definitely ready to use, and an onion. And I didn't put garlic in that one. I did put bone broth in that one, but you could do it with water. And you just cook them, and then you run them through the blender, and then you add milk and cream. So it's the milk base, the stock base, stock or water. Or then, of course, there's the tomato base, which you can use for, you know, minestrones, which can be almost anything.
All those wonderful packages of things that you, yes, you thought of yourself.
And you know, bean base is another good idea, too.
One
thing, I did a black bean with a million vegetables that I was rooting around and found in the freezer.
Go in the freezer and find those things, yeah.
And so one of my tricks for bean base is, you know, you have to cook them till they're really done. Nothing worse than hard beans in your soup. But once I've reached that point of really well doneness, then I take about half of the beans. I mean, you can use any proportion you want. And I actually puree them in the food processor, which gives you a really, really creamy base. And then you leave half of the beans or a portion of the beans whole, which gives you the little lumps that you want. But beans themselves make a lovely base for soup. So, you know, just get creative with those crock pots or those soup pots, and because spring will be upon us and we won't want to have soup anymore.
Yes. Spring is coming, but in the meantime, dive down into that freezer. There's something back there that is just talking to you. I just know it is. Those little labeled packages. So have fun. Have fun. Ah, spring, yes. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Support community radio. Contact us. What's on your plate? Community radio means that you can be part of this, too. We are all volunteers here, and we would love to hear your opinions on peppers, sweet peppers, hot peppers, lots of things. Do you have a favorite recipe?
Yeah, or if you have any good tricks, let us know.
Oh, let us know. And heaven knows, we have opinions. I'm sure you do, too. What's on your plate? You can contact us by going to KHOI FM.org. And put Donna Lana Kitchen in the headline so it kind of finds its way to us. Let us know what you'd like to talk about. Let us know what you are eating. Yes, yes. Ah, spring. We'll go out with a little bit of music here, thinking about dancing, yes. This is a square dance tune, and it's called Goodbye My Lady Love, and it's from a CD called Full Swing. And it's called by Susan Kevra. So if you feel the need, grab your partner. You can dance this even if you don't have a full set. I know you can. This is the square dance called Goodbye My Lady Love. My name is Lana Noctigal.
Ooh. And I'm Donna Prisgintas, and I have crackers and hot pepper jelly in my mouth.
Good for you. Engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life. Yes.
Around that square. Turn your partner by the left hand, then leave him there and swing your corner for a long time. Swing me that corner guy. He's got a roving eye. Oh, hurt me, refuse me. You'll be sorry when you lose me. Promenade, look, and I'll take you home. I always said you'd roam. Oh, goodbye, my lady love, goodbye. Turn your partner by the left hand, you go once and a half. Now the lady star by the right hand, go once around that square. Turn your partner by the left hand. swing your corner, ready to swing. Swing me that corner guy, he's got a roving eye. You hurt me, refuse me, you'll be sorry when you lose me. Comedy, look and I'll take you home. I always said you'd roam, oh, goodbye, my lady love, goodbye. Alaman left on the corner, Alaman left, then weave around. You're leaving me, I'm leaving town. Now, gypsy, by the ride, oh, look me in the eye. Your corner, too, it makes me cry. Swing your partner, swing me, my lady love. You are my turtle dove, oh, you are the darling and the idol of my heart now. Comedy, look, and I'll take you home. I always said you'd roam, oh, goodbye, my lady love, goodbye. Gem star, I'm on the right hand, star right. Around you go, your partner left. Oh, please don't go. And the lady star right hand, star right, around that square. Turn your partner left and leave him there. And swing your corner for a long time. Swing me that corner guy, he's got a roving eye. Oh, hurt me, refuse me, you'll be sorry when you lose me. Promise me, look and I'll take you home. I always said you'd roam, oh, goodbye, my lady love, goodbye. The right hand, star right, around you go. Your partner left, oh, please, please don't go. Now the ladies, star right hand, star right, around that square. Your partner left, then you leave him there. Swing your corner, swing me that corner guy. He's got a roving eye, oh, hurt me, refuse me. You'll be sorry when you lose me. Promise me, look and I'll take you home. I always said you'd roam, oh, goodbye, my lady love, goodbye. Alaman left on the corner, Alaman left, then leave around. You're leaving me, I'm leaving town. Now, gypsy, by the right, oh, look me in the eye. Your corner, too, it makes me cry. Swing your partners on, swing me, my lady love. You are my turtle dove, oh, you are the darling and the idol of my heart. Look and I'll take you home. I always say you're wrong. Swing me, my lady love.